Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Before I introduce this week's guest, I need to let you know that there will be no weekly podcast on the 4th of July. Instead, you can tune in on the 2nd of July for the first installment of Physics World Live, which will focus on quantum sensors. Featuring a panel of experts, this live event will explore the extraordinary capabilities of quantum sensors and look at how they could benefit humanity and shape our understanding of the world. You can find out more on the Physics World website. Just click on the Physics World Live tab near the top of the homepage. In this episode, I'm in conversation with the physicist Stephanie Simmons, who is founder and chief quantum officer of Vancouver-based Photonic Inc. The company is developing optically linked silicon spin qubits, and it has recently announced that it has distributed quantum entanglement between two of its modules. Recently, I caught up with Stephanie in London, where she was speaking at the Commercializing Quantum Global 2024 conference. Here is that conversation. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Stephanie, can you explain how Photonic's silicon-based quantum computing platform works?
Absolutely. So, Photonic Inc., we are using photons to glue processors together. We are fundamentally working on distributed quantum computing. And so, what do I mean by that? I mean the ability to take individual quantum processing units and link them together, just like we do with conventional supercomputers for classical computing, is taking individual modules and rack mounting them and having horizontal scale. So we are heads down on using photons to glue all of these pieces together. And the pieces that we're gluing together, we're using spin qubits, and it's in silicon, and it's using telecom photons to link them together. So that's the core of the technology, and that's why we're moving as quickly as we are.
I see. Okay. And is this because you're using photons, is it a sort of a linear technology, or are you having the photons interacting with each other?
Oh,
or is it
lovely.
A bit of both?
Oh, lovely. Yes. So this is the beautiful part about working backwards from the large scale quantum technology that we want to build. As soon as you're using photons to glue things together, you no longer need the individual qubits within each module to essentially overlap one another to get their interactions. So yeah, the picture is that you take spin qubits in silicon. These ones are photonically active spin qubits in silicon. What you do is you trigger them to emit individual photons, which are entangled with the spins that leave behind. And then you get those two photons to interfere. So that's diving right into the technical detail right out of the gate, but it does mean that you can think about scale in a completely different way. You can think about engineering these quantum systems in a completely different way to what's been traditionally assumed to be true for this space. So that's one of the reasons why we are using this and leveraging it to scale rapidly.
Okay, so Stephanie, what are the challenges that you face in scaling up the technology to create a practical quantum computer?
Well, I think this is a wonderful question because we're taking that scale challenge very seriously from the ground up. The way that we've been looking at quantum technologies is there's going to be three phases of quantum technology development. The first phase is the phase that we're in right now, which is what I would call the NISQ phase, or this noisy intermediate scale quantum phase, where there's a small number of quantum particles all within one box that have some performance characteristics, but you can't do error correction. Phase two is when those single boxes get good enough, or the quantum ingredients within them get good enough to do error correction. And that's where we hope to start seeing some more interesting use cases come out of quantum. But the real market opportunity is in this phase three quantum supercomputer phase, right? So the scale challenge is so integral to quantum technologies because the only algorithms where we know there's mathematical proof of product market fit is in that phase three supercomputer phase. And for us, that means having networked quantum computing, thinking about the quantum network as a core ingredient to that scale challenge. And it's not the sort of thing that you can just add in later. If you take a look at the way quantum systems and quantum computers have been evolving, putting on an interconnect, putting on a photonic interconnect after the fact doesn't work very well. You actually have to very much go back to the building blocks to think about, how do I scale this technology? And so it is a bit of it's a newcomer to the space. For sure, it's a newcomer to the quantum space, but it is engineered with scale in mind, right? It's leveraging silicon. It's leveraging the manufacturability of silicon. It's leveraging telecom photons and all of the telecom infrastructure. And so we're already out of the box. That's one of the most interesting things we were excited to share with the world last week, was the ability to do distributed logic, distributed computing using these basic building blocks. So by working backwards from the end in mind, we can have these core components and scale quickly and no longer be constrained to the size of any one box.
And these components, are they the sorts of things that can be manufactured relatively easily using standard semiconductor processes? Is that the aim, to tailor something that can actually be built?
Exactly. It's so important if we're going to be trying to get commercial value out of these systems to think about manufacturability from day one. So if you work backwards from the assertion that photons are going to glue together large-scale quantum supercomputers in a network, you have to also be thinking about what are the integrated photonics platforms that give you that core capability. And silicon is exactly that. The other core photonic capability you care about is telecom, right? There's so much telecom low loss infrastructure that'll allow us to route these photons around and get entanglement where it needs to be. So absolutely, manufacturability is so important to how we should be engineering for these large scale quantum supercomputers. And that's why the spin photon interfaces that we're working with, we've chosen the T center in silicon. It's a specific small molecule that emits these photons and has great spin qubit properties, but it's a telecom object right in the silicon. And we can implant the constituents and do some heat treatment. And it's just like regular silicon processing. It's one of the reasons we can move as quickly as we have.
I see. And this T center, is that something that's similar to an NV center in diamond?
Is that
the same sort of an idea?
Brilliant. Yes, brilliant. Yes, it's part of that category of spin photon interfaces where you have not only the spin that can offer phenomenal quantum characteristics. So we've set world records for coherence times with spins in silicon, but these are, spins in semiconductors have that capability. But yes, what's different between the NV center and this is, instead of diamond, we have the manufacturability and processing capability of silicon. We already have silicon photonics, silicon on insulator. It just leverages a lot. And the second change is that we're using telecom wavelengths for light. So it allows us to network these things much more easily. But there's also some little details that make a big, big difference. That's a bit of a difference between the NV center and the T center, which is perhaps a little too technical to get into here.
This is physics world. So if you want to get into it, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, there are opportunities to keep the fidelity of everything a little bit higher through the optical cycle. There's more spins that you can use. So there's more spins in the T center than the nitrogen center. So you have more local processing capabilities. So the T center has a hydrogen and two carbon atoms in addition to an electron that can give you that spin photon interface, that photonic interconnect. So you have three nuclear spins that are all amazing, and they can be protected against optical cycles. If you're just, that's as far as I'll go here, but I think it makes a big difference in terms of the performance of a large scale system.
Okay. And I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar to NV centers, and there's a lot of work being done on how to create them in a controlled way. So with these T centers, is it something that you can use, ion implantation or something to put them exactly where you want them?
That's exactly
right. Your system.
That's exactly right. So if you're working with a integrated photonic system, you only need the T center localized to within 50 nanometers. and we actually can get better than 10 nanometers. So yeah, we can implant them where they want, and we can create more than enough, like the density can be very high. So yeah, the manufacturability is important. That's why when we went looking for it, we went looking for the T-Center a few years ago before the company got started. We were looking with exactly that lens, right? You were looking back in the literature and seeing what formed naturally and drawing from that literature to find the secret ingredient to unlock a telecom spin photon interface.
Okay. And, I don't want to, dwell on these T-centers for too long, but I mean, I suppose they are fascinating to physicists. So it's probably not your interest in the company at the moment, but do they also have applications for sensing in the same way that NV centers do?
It's a wonderful question. We are very much interested in how isolated these are, right? So sensors indicate an environmental sensitivity, which actually you don't want in a high-performing compute system or a networking system. But I will say that this is the same technology you need for networks. So let me dive into that for a second. The thing that has been limiting scale for quantum is quantum network, for quantum computing has been the lack of quantum networking. But I would say the other side is also true. The thing that's been limiting quantum networks has been distance, which requires essentially small quantum computers to give you repeaters, right? The repeaters give you that distance. It gives you the ability to scale users because multiple users can plug into a single repeater. And that scale has been missing on the networking side. And so this is just one more reason why telecom wavelengths matter so much, right? Because if you're going to be working on a combined networked quantum computing solution, you have to be at those wavelengths. You have to be right at those telecom wavelengths. So what I would say is that this really does merge the quantum technology streams of networks and computing into one platform. And I think anything that tries to go it alone is going to have a scaling issue. So that will at some point need to be addressed, right? So that's why, you can use the entanglement distribution of a network to link into sensors, but it's not a direct one-for-one like you alluded to with the NV center magnetometers, for example.
Okay, right. Okay, no more questions about T-centers.
Hell, they're great. They're really interesting.
Sorry about going off script there, but that's why these interviews are fun. So Stephanie, what are some of the quantum computing applications that the technology is particularly suited for?
Yes. So in this phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 conversation for quantum technologies, we're very much focused on these phase 3 applications. And what do I mean by that? The known exponential speedup algorithms requiring usually upwards of 1,000 logical qubits with very good logical error rates, right? To do amazing things like help on the drug discovery pipeline or the cryptography side, any of those kinds of known exponential speedups where there's quote unquote mathematical proof of product market fit, where you can go and crunch through the deterministic algorithms and say, okay, you have this many logical qubits, you can get a deterministic result. That's exciting for us because what we want to do first and foremostly is unlock value for people, because then it starts a flywheel of other investment and opportunity seeking for these systems. That is not to say that there may or may not be value in this phase 2 era. The phase 2 era is where everything's boxed, constrained to a single box, where yours only maybe a couple hundred at most logical qubits. So the applications that get me up in the morning on the chemistry side, or on the chemistry side in particular. So there is a molecule that was identified, well, many people know about it, but Google did the good work to identify it as a quantum target, which is the CYP molecule. And they call it CYP. And this thing metabolizes 70% of human drugs, 70%. And they don't know how to simulate it with a computer at all because it has the heavy elements that really do require quantum computers to have tools fit for purpose, right? So if we could understand how that molecule worked, we would be able to better predict how drugs would get through or not the entire late stage trials process, right? And how much would that save on everybody's cycle? So that one would be excellent. The other one is catalysts, right? So catalysts have heavy elements in them and they just can't be simulated. So right now we seem to just chuck a whole bunch of options on the wall and see what works. But we're going to need some pretty key developments on the catalyst side to rework our entire energy system, right? The catalysts help everything unlock. So having a tool fit for purpose to understand how they work would be just transformative. So those are the ones that get me up in the morning, let's say, but I'm most, in the long term, fascinated by what we don't yet know. And so I like to use the classical semiconductor computing as an example here. Every time you commercialize a branch of physics, at the outset, you have no idea what the actual use cases and applications are. And it's actually very rare do you get to see it in advance. So much so that when the transistor first came on the scene, people weren't necessarily excited about things like Facebook. They thought the key application was hearing aids, right? Because they already had vacuum tube computers. So they're like, okay, fine. It can be lighter and smaller a little bit. Great. Let's make a hearing aid. Like that was the application, right? So you can't always see where things are going to go. And I'm most excited to see what this computational power can do once we've had a broader generation of people developing use cases for it, especially after we get them up and online, where we can then start playing with like the heuristic algorithms, where you don't have a deterministic number of qubits that you need to do a thing, right? AI is a great example of a heuristic. All the optimization algorithms we have today are all heuristics. They just seem to work, right? So where it's not anchored to a computational complexity argument, for example. So I'm excited to see what quantum can do in that phase. And that was quite a long answer, but I hope that
That's fine. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, but you mentioned, you know, needing about 1,000 logical qubits. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sort of suggests to me that you're going to be doing some sort of error correction with lots more real qubits.
Yes, sir.
So are you talking about sort of a million real qubits, or can you do it with fewer, or do you have to use more, or what?
I love this question because this was the elephant in the room for the first decade or two of quantum technology development. And people were just having a hard time getting their heads around the fact that it seemed to be hard to make 50 qubits, and yet we needed millions to do anything of value. I would say that fortunately, there has been a lot of excellent physics and computer science that have gone into making those goalposts 20 years closer. And I'll share with you how that's possible. If you go with conventional assumptions on how error correction works for quantum, you're absolutely right. You need like 3,000 physical qubits for every one logical qubit, right? It seems like difficult to imagine that, certainly not within any one box. You are definitely going to benefit from horizontal scalability to hit those kinds of numbers.
I think earlier at the conference, someone referred to it as a factory.
Oh my
you need
gosh,
a there's a quantum factory to do the
calculation. There's so much. But fortunately, if you actually work backwards from success and you take a look at what the best quantum codes are, it's actually not the ones that people have been engineering for. People have been engineering for planar codes because the systems that they were trained up on used proximity to do their multi-qubit gates, to do their CNOT gates. But that's not at all what you're not restricted to that at all. If you're working with a networked quantum technology, you can string these things together any way you want. Photons are great at moving around and interconnecting, and they don't talk to each other, right? You can put two flashlights or two torches, let's say, at 90 degrees, and those photons carry through just fine, right? You can get these routed all over the place. But when you do that, then you have the opportunity to connect them the best way, or rather optimize them for error correction. And what used to take 3,000 physical takes 30, right? So these codes that exist, they're actually 5G codes that have been quote unquote made quantum. They're called quantum LDPC codes. If you haven't heard about them, I do suggest you go up and read on them, because they have moved the quantum goalpost 20 years closer for everyone who can actually implement those codes. Those overheads go from scary down to achievable.
So, Stephanie, can you tell me a bit about Photonic Inc., the company? How many employees do you have, and what R&D facilities are available to you? So you're based in Vancouver, where you're based.
That's right.
But yeah, You've got some other offices around the world as well. Can you tell us a bit about the company.
Yeah, that's right. So I started, just to wind back and give a bit of context, I started as a professor to go find these spin-photon interfaces based out in Vancouver. And in 2020, we found and shared with the world the T-Center. So we have been essentially a COVID-born company. We got the green light on our first investment round in 2021. So we're quite a young company, but we're already doing distributed quantum computing, right? So it is moving fast by standing on the shoulders of giants. So in that short time, we've gained a phenomenal team. We have 140 people, but they're not all based in Vancouver. Our strategy has absolutely been quality, not quantity. And so we tap the world's best on the shoulders, no matter where they live in the world. And we have a pretty good hit rate once we share what we're up to and where we're going, because that scalability argument is just, it is compelling for people. So we do, yes, have offices in the States, and we have offices in the UK, and we have team members all over Europe and North America. So it's a great team. It's lots of time zones, but it's absolutely a phenomenal environment and the best minds to engage with.
Okay. And so how many people do you have, and what are they, mostly PhDs in physics or electrical engineering? Is that the sort of stage that the company's at the moment?
It's a great question. Actually, we don't have as many PhDs as you'd think, because a lot of the work to be done is on the engineering. So like electrical engineering, absolutely, but there's cryogenic engineering and mechanical engineering and lots of professional software engineers. We have, we even have a machinist. We do the full stack on the quantum side, and those are mostly PhDs. And on the integrated photonic side, we do an agile hardware cycle, which means we have independent supply chains on two different manufacturing supply chains. And we turn over a chip every day, every 2 days, and we have quite an operations team that's going through on a professional silicon photonics basis. So yeah, there are physicists, but the work to be done for scaling these systems is a lot of engineering physics, let's say.
Okay. But I mean, if there is a physicist out there, and I'm sure there are people listening to this thinking, wow, you know, how can I get into this industry? It sounds fascinating. What sort of advice would you give, somebody who's, I don't know, maybe they're finishing an undergraduate degree in physics, or maybe they've just done a PhD and they'd really like to get into the quantum biz?
Right. I think it's absolutely a good idea. What happens with technology development, if you take a look at history, is that there is, when you commercialize a branch of physics, every single time this has happened, there's usually a Cambrian explosion of different opportunities. So for right now, we have a whole bunch of different quantum platforms. But honestly, even if only one or two of them end up being the dominant form of quantum technology, everybody in the industry ends up benefiting. There ends up being a consolidation event where everybody kind of comes together, and there's mergers and the rest of it, and people all still start rowing the boat in the same direction. And there's a massive talent shortage, because usually that happens once commercial advantage or commercial acceleration exists, right? So there's money to be made. So I would say, yeah, in my time in quantum, certainly the compensation's been phenomenal for anybody in the quantum tech space. I would say that it's also extremely competitive, which it's actually a really good thing, because it means that the people you get to spend time with are all brilliant usually. And you get to do something meaningful, right? So they're very motivated as well. So I would absolutely recommend it, especially as things are progressing ever more quickly towards a kind of consolidated view, I would say, on how to do large-scale useful quantum tech, right? These new codes make a lot of sense. Distributed quantum computing makes a lot of sense. People are starting to converge. So the timing to get into it is quite good. And there's lots of interest in people just want to know what quantum means for them now, right? So there's a lot of interest in being aware of what that is from a job opportunity and being able to trade that in the market.
And it sounds to me that maybe the qubit flavor that you choose doesn't matter. If you join a company that's working on superconducting qubits or silicon qubits or ion-based qubits, does that not matter in the long run? You're not going to hit a dead end with that in the industry. You could move For example, would you hire a very good person who's worked on superconducting qubits to come into your company, even if they don't, they wouldn't have the technical background?
Well, we're in a position where our qubits are so young, they're toddler qubits, right? That we only shared them with, we went and found them, mm-hmm. and we shared their existence with the world in 2020. So everybody that we've hired, if they didn't come up through the ranks in my research program, had to come from another branch of quantum technologies. So yeah, I do see in the long term, which hardware modality is maybe less relevant. I think if you were to invest in the really long term, it would make sense to pick something that did talk to photons. There's really no way that in the large scale, photons aren't going to be a part of the networked quantum system.
When you say photons, do you mean not microwaves, as in superconducting qubits, what we think of as light, visible light?
Oh, that's a great question. There is more transferable knowledge than you would think. Actually, I would say there's almost more transferable knowledge from microwave photons over to spin photon interfaces than from the pure spin community, where they don't have to necessarily think about cavity coupling or any of those dynamics, right? So it is a lot more transferable than you think. And yes, we've definitely hired supercon people and ion trap people and neutral atom people. And you do want to be able to draw from that broad base of quantum experience, because ultimately these are electromagnetic fields and quantum qubits that go through the same kind of control characteristics usually, right? So there is a lot more transferable than you'd think. But I do say that, the stack side is also very, very interesting, where you can come from different versions of the quantum stack and still transfer over. So if you're working on...
So when you say stack, what does that mean?
Yeah. So like if you're a focused expert on one branch of quantum error correction, and you feel like, oh, hey, maybe this new kind of error correction is where I should be spending my efforts, that is an easy jump to make too. And yeah, I don't see it as a especially with the increasing awareness of how cross-compatible the various challenges are. But it is absolutely worth getting in deep. It is worth understanding the very deep details, because you would be shocked at how frequently they come up in adjacent environments, right?
Right. So when you say deep, do you mean understanding the physics?
Yeah. So like, for example, charge noise. I don't know a single platform that doesn't care about charge noise. Charges are in reality. We care about reality, right? We care about interfaces. Interfaces affect everything. Everything will have charge noise on it. Understanding that, yeah, that's very transferable. How do you think about gate compilation? Right? It's the same regardless of what you're mapping it to. You have certain considerations that are that apply in quite a versatile way, right? So there's a lot more transferable than you would think, but getting to understand what really makes or breaks a given technology allows you to better navigate going forward, right?
Well, that's great. Well, thanks, Stephanie. Thanks for that advice on how to get into the quantum industry, and also telling us about the company as well. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much for your very insightful questions.
That was Stephanie Simmons of Photonic Inc. We chatted during the Commercializing Quantum Global 2024 conference in London, which is organized by Economist Impact. Stay tuned over the next few weeks for more conversations inspired by that conference. We're getting really excited about the launch of Physics World Live, a series of online panel debates in which you can join leading scientists discussing hot topics in physics and put your questions to the experts. First up is Physics World Live Quantum Sensors, which is on the 2nd of July, 2024. You'll find out why quantum sensors could be the quantum 2.0 technology with the greatest potential for near-term, real-world applications. On September 26th, join us for Physics World Live, The Future of Particle Physics, where we mark the 70th anniversary of CERN by debating where the world's next collider should be. Finally, on the 21st of November, there's Physics World Live Battery Technology, we'll discuss how efficient batteries will play a vital role in the transition to a low-carbon, green economy. Register now for all three free events by going to the Physics World Live section of the Physics World website. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Stephanie Simmons for chatting with me today, and a special thanks to our producer, Fred Isles. We'll be back again next week.